Because It's There with Sarah Khumalo is proudly sponsored by Vuma. Connection lies at the heart of everything Vuma does. It drives important conversations, brings communities together, and creates opportunities for greatness. Connecting Africa's women empowers them to be extraordinary, and we are here to do that. Visit vumatel.co.za for more.
Hello, everybody. Good morning, good evening, wherever you are joining us. Welcome. This is Sarah Khumalo, your host on Because It's There, a podcast that looks at leadership, a podcast that reminds us that it doesn't matter who we are, what happened to us yesterday, where we are on our journey. We are all leaders. We are all extraordinary, irrespective of what's happening in that moment. And on this podcast, I've been able to bring amazing people that have given us insights on their journey to success, on their journey to be amazing African leaders. And today is no exception. I've got none other than Dr. Brenda Didi Kovane. Dr. Brenda, and I actually call you my brr. You know, I know that I'm taking that from our own sister Brenda. Thank you so much for making time to join us. And today we are focusing on risky business because that's your passion. And before we get into it, I'd love for us to break the ice with a statement that I'll make, and I'd like for you to finish it off. You know, one thing in life that is not absolute is fill in the blank. And I love it.
A man's fate, and I love it.
Oh, wow. Tell us a little bit more about that. What do you mean?
Well, Sarah, I've seen through my own life that, you know, where you come from does not determine where you go. Today does not determine tomorrow. And the events that happen in your life, they shape you. They shape you for a destiny that you can own. You know, you come within your own. So one thing that's not absolute is a man's fate.
Absolutely. Love it. I'm going to adopt that. Thank you. So I'll start with your values. You know, we've shared a few talks. You know, you have an interesting journey, one that started with you growing up in El Dorado with different aspirations and different environment, and what you would kind of hope for or aim for was completely different. And later moving on to live with your mother, who's an educator, I believe, and changing your views on education, you know, and what you were capable of as an African child, as an African girl. What would you say is the difference between the two environments that you were in? And is there such a thing as your environment will determine where you end up?
Mm. Sarah, those two environments are very different. Like you said, I grew up, I was born in Johannesburg at Bara, and I grew up in El Dorado Park. Many people know El Dorado Park these days, with the news and the events that are happening there. I stayed in El Dorado Park up until the age of 13 and moved to live with my mum, my biological mum in the Eastern Cape. Like you said, very different environment. I ended up in, I'll call it rural suburbs because the area is rural, but however it was a suburban area. Very different in the sense that my mum was working at the University of Transkei. She was an academic, a researcher. Yet when I grew up in El Dorado Park, I grew up in the flats. And I was doing what every child in El Dorado Park does, you know, walking the streets of El Dorado Park, running, going out to swim at the public pool, you know. A very exciting life, but it was very different from where I landed up when I was 13. Different in which sense? Socially, very different. But I think as a child, what sticks out for me now as an adult when I think of it was that as a child, I didn't know, I didn't understand my capabilities because of the level of exposure that I had. The world at that time in the 80s in El Dorado Park was not so open to me. So I only aspired for the things that I saw. What did Brenda as a young child see? I saw in the flats many women, men that entered into the Patco bus wearing their uniforms, going to game, okay. And we lived good lives, you know. We were happy, we were content. And my aspiration at the time was to become a clinique beauty consultant at Edgar's, because that was admirable. And I never thought about the academic space. I never wondered whether I could become a doctor or a CA. Yes, I knew there were doctors, but I never, my mind never stretched as far as to understanding how you become that and what do you do. So I think the level of exposure I had was quite limited. Now, moving to the Eastern Cape, being surrounded by academia, academics, being surrounded by many people that had attained certain level of education, it really opened my eyes. So when I moved, I had for years, obviously, I was born there, so I spoke Afrikaans. I had to transition into a space where I was speaking now English and Xhosa, which I learned only when I was 13, you know. And that environment pushed me. The level of exposure I had pushed me. And not because I didn't have the capability and I wasn't born with it, but I think it's because I had not been exposed to certain things. And that exposure from an academic point of view, from a culture point of view, opened my eyes. And from that moment, I was able to dream big. And hence, I believe sometimes that all anyone has to do is to dream. And if you can create an environment where someone can dream, that person is able to achieve far more than they themselves would think of themselves. So yes, very two different environments, but they had shaped me in all ways. I cannot tell you from a mindset, from a thinking, from a life perspective point of view, it has been shaped by both environments. I think of myself as a very dynamic person because of that, because of my merger of two worlds, completely different worlds. And I find it beautiful in itself. No regrets.
Love it. You may not have ended up in clinics, you know, as a beautician, yeah, but you're on point with your makeup every time.
Thank you.
Absolutely. So outlier events are seen as experiences with high impact and low probability. I think that's something in risk you probably understand only too well. So your story of convincing the University of Transkei to take you on for both BSc computer science as well as BCom as a young Black African woman at the age of 18 in 1998 was an outlier event in my mind, especially for the time that it was just after independence. Where did you gain the tenacity to just go in and say, this is me and this is what I want?
Look, Sarah, even today, I take that as my biggest achievement in life. And I find that Brenda at 18, a very confident young girl. And I think it started out with realizing, like I said, the journey that I had moving from El Dorado Park and going to Mthatha, not knowing English, learning English at the age of 13, learning my home language at age 15, and then being able to succeed academically and get awards and prizes for subjects, and having, for someone that initially didn't even understand English and couldn't even read it, I realized that actually, I can do what I put my mind to it with obviously the hard work and effort, but I realized that I can achieve what I set my mind to. And that is what really happened in this particular instance. I felt, and at that time, I thought that the world is my oyster. I can learn and experience everything and anything I wish to. And I found that it shouldn't be limited by a rule that has been set by an institution to say that you can do one course. And that was my challenge to university, to say that, why am I being limited for what I know I can do mentally and physically? Why not give me a chance and I can prove it? And yes, I went on my journey. I had to obviously attend the BCom classes at night with the night students and my BSc courses during the day. I managed to pass in record time. So I've got a very long transcript of all these mixed courses. But I think the point for me was really to say that I have no limits. And I only put on limits to myself, you know. And I think I prove that to myself at that age, at age 19. But actually, the first time I proved it to myself was at the age of 13, when I had to learn the English that I had to study with and still managed to be one of the students that were deemed as top students within the school. So at a very early age, 13, I proved it. At 18, I proved it. And that is why I believe in educating and putting kids forward, because they can achieve great things.
I love that, Brenda. So as the chief risk officer, you know, and you'd probably be the first to tell us that risk management is a wide topic. And yet you're so passionate about dynamic risk. When was that first aha moment when that became your thing for you to focus on? And obviously, I'm sure it's one of the things that you focused on in your PhD dissertation.
Yes. So I was fortunate enough after school to go into the auditing space. And I later on went into the risk environment. And I found risk to be a very interesting profession. It's one of those that applies everywhere, in any industry, all the time. And it needs a certain personality. So I always say that to be a risk manager, you need to be able to be flexible. You need to understand different businesses, different processes, as even though you're not working with the business every single day, you know? So it takes a lot of understanding and learning and analytics. So as much as the profession itself has been defined in a linear way, the people that actually execute on this function are quite dynamic in nature. Because when you'll see, when you're an external auditor, you move from the mining industry to the to financial services within weeks, you know, and you have to catch it just like that and review environments. And that requires a certain level of flexibility, agility, and skill. And only certain individuals can actually successfully perform that. Now, one thing that I felt passionate about was that if the person in nature is a dynamic kind of individual that has to do this profession, why are we limited by a more linear approach to risk management? Because these days, things are dynamic. We talk about agile principles. We talk about business resilience. And it all really means that everything keeps on changing. Nothing is constant. So therefore, as a risk professional that is required to identify threats and opportunities, you need to be able to execute it in a way that is dynamic in nature. You need to be able to move with the business, and you need to be able to execute in such a way that is always relevant to that point in time for the business. So I discovered this, Sarah, very early on, I think while I was still working at Standard Bank. And I think when I joined Momentum, I had the opportunity to exercise what I believed risk management should look like. And that was because I was now in a much senior role as a CRO, and I had to implement those procedures and practices. And I had the ability, obviously within bounds, to execute in a way I saw necessary for the business. And that also was my passion, because I did it in my PhD. And honestly speaking, today, I find that everybody should know the important tool that we have is risk management in decision making. But it is important and vital that we understand that it has to be agile. It has to be dynamic in nature, and it has to be relevant and suitable for the business at that point in time. And if it's going to be agile and dynamic, it means that it allows for change. Absolutely. And that's what I love, that it won't be constant.
Yeah. I love that. Most people kind of shy away from risk, I'm sure. So risk and auditors, eish.
Yeah. Yes.
I think maybe that's the traditional risk and auditing. What do you think has changed? How is it evolving? What have you seen from the time you started to today? What has shifted in how you conduct your business as a chief risk officer?
Yeah, I think definitely the attention to risk management has shifted in all industries. When you read articles or anything around corporate governance, you'll see the shift and the importance of risk management. But I think besides the more formal governance, I think there has been value has been placed by executive business owners, the boards, in terms of the value risk management can give in terms of decision making from a strategic point of view. And that they have seen also that risk management is not just there for threats, because people think you're just there to tick a box and highlight all the bad things, but it's also there to highlight opportunities. And business is more and more seeing that this is a vehicle to also identify future opportunities. And I think if you look at it in that context, you'll see how it has evolved and how the importance of it has now evolved with industry and with the business world. Yeah, so it's a very exciting place really right now for the risk professionals. And I mean, with the pandemic, we were tested. So another one that shows that at the end of the day, nothing can be guaranteed. Threats are there, but it's how you manage it that defines your true success.
Absolutely. It's like failing forward. But I'm sure yes. Lessons have been learned through the pandemic and how business and individuals were affected in the process. Anyway, yes. Let's go back to you, Mabr, right? Who has been the most important shaper in your journey? And I'll define who a shaper is, right? If, when you climb Everest, you use these guides that guide you. They don't climb for you, but they look at your blind spots. They pick them up. They partner with you. But when you get up there, the self is on you and you walk your own journey. It's like coaches, mm-hmm. like guides on a hike. And who has for you been the most important shaper? It may be one, it may be two, it may be many if you are like me, you know, for different reasons. And, yeah. And how did you get into contact with them?
Yeah. Look, Sarah, I've had quite a few when it comes to that regard, because I've had in my journey, I've had many points where I needed various shapers with different skills and techniques to guide me. I think in my early years, like I said, during a time of complete change, when I was 30, one of them was a lady called Nelly Somagazi. She was my housekeeper. Nelly Swa understood, because at the time, remember, I had just moved. So yes, my mom was there, but she played a role of someone who understood the change I was going through in terms of daily, you know, child activities at school, my integration in school, someone I could be open with. And because of that, she helped me navigate that world, because remember, the culture was different. How I had to interact at school was different. I was different because I was this Black girl knowing Afrikaans now with people that looked like me but were very different from me, you know. And she understood, because she was young enough. She understood my challenges, but she could help me navigate that particular world, you know. The next person also was a lady, Nelly Swa has passed on, unfortunately. The next person was Miss Norton. She was a teacher at the school. She also has sadly passed on, but she was a young teacher, a colored teacher, that I think just connected and understood my world. So as much as I was like everybody else in the school, I had a sense of there was something different, because I came from a different environment and I had to adjust. So she created a sense of things that were familiar to me. But she also, because she was an educator at the school, she allowed me to integrate myself in that environment and allowed me to pinpoint things that could be my strong and strengths, or my strong points that I could utilize to have a better life in my journey of education and as schooling. And she she really was impactful in that sense. And I think a lot of the successes that I probably had in terms of later on being acknowledged for the prizes at school came because of her guidance. Then I obviously have my mother. You know, most people, they would say a bond between a mother and a child develops from birth, right? I got to know my mother intimately only really at age 16. But that gave me another opportunity. It gave me an opportunity to understand my mother as a woman, as not as my parent, but as a person and as a woman. And to look at her life and her decisions from a viewpoint that was hers. Now, with that said, she then was able to connect with me as a girl, as a woman, and guide me through my life, my experiences in that context. I've got a very good relationship with my mom. And I always laugh and say that it's so funny that it's perceived as a relationship as a mother and daughter, but we know it's a woman-to-woman relationship. So she is one of my strongest guides in all aspects of my life, whether it's personal or my career aspirations, or just emotionally and spiritually. So she has played that big role, but I think the blessing has been that we connected at age 16, and she has become the most valuable guide I could ever have, but from a context of being a woman. Then I think I've been fortunate, Sarah, in my career to have met a lady that navigated the business world, helped me navigate the business world. And recently also I've managed to be connected with a brilliant man at Momentum who guides me in the risk fraternity. You know, Jan Libber, he's played a very key role in guiding me and growing even my own profession. So I'm one of those lucky ones, Sarah, you know, that have many guides for many points and many journeys. Like, I'm blessed in that regard, honestly.
Absolutely. I love that. I think it's starting with somebody that worked for the family. That was humbling. We always think, I can learn from these people or not from these people. There's so many people that can guide us. We can learn something from everybody. Yes. I from my children sometimes, and I'm like, oh, how did you think that, you know? Yes. So that's really humbling, and it says a lot about who you are as an individual. Mm. I appreciate that. Mm. So let's go back to risk. You know, you are risk management, you are a risk management specialist at heart. I mean, I've seen you at work, right? How do you think organizations have evolved in assessing risk over time? I mean, you touched on COVID and how it affected businesses. What is glaringly different from where we started and how it's evolved over time?
Yeah, I think what is significantly different now in risk management is the recognition in terms of the need for change.
Yeah.
You know, that it's not a tick box, that it's a fundamental tool. That it is one of those tools that you can use in strategic decisions, but also it is also a way in which you can sense and seize opportunities. I think that's also quite a big one, because when you look at today's risk management, we quite heavily focus in terms of understanding emerging risks. And risk management is not just about business operations, it's about everything. We talk about climate change, economic affairs. We're starting to realize how different factors are impacting whether it's organizations and society. You know, it's impacting, and we need to look at it and assess it all together. So it's more of a holistic way of looking at risk management. And I think it's one of those areas now where you learn far more than you probably would have learned before. Before it was financial risk management, but now we find matters such as economic affairs, environmental affairs, as important as your strategic, because they influence your business or your society. So it has evolved. It's far more interesting, and that is why it needs to be more dynamic.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's a very exciting time.
Absolutely. I suppose that's why we're getting more and more younger people going in, because previously, I used to see it was normally older lawyers, that's where they retired. That's my take.
Yeah.
So you also have a passion for development as well, especially the development of women and children. Most societies share your values, and that's why they thrive, right? What do you think is holding South Africa back in this regard?
Yeah, I think one of the first ones which we sometimes want to shy away from is women equality. And that is equality in homes, in households, at the workplace, and just generally in society. So that's the first one. And I know some people get tired of the topic, but women equality, that's the first. The second one is women supporting women. And I don't mean Black women supporting Black women or white women supporting white women. I mean women supporting women. You know, that for me is one of the things that I think women themselves has to see as a strength. And if not applied, it is limiting in terms of making sure we develop ourselves as women. The other one is the legacy of family. I think as South Africa, we need to define what is the legacy of family when it comes to our sets of beliefs, when it comes to our values, when it comes to just our attitudes, you know, and what we want to pass on from generation to generation, and particularly to our children. So I think those three things for me are the things that are putting us back as South Africa, you know, in terms of just the development of both women and children, because the legacy element feeds a lot into children, and children, not just girl children, because I believe in children and not girl children. We've got both boys and girls.
Absolutely. I think that's quite key. It's a world that has both genders. We need to be careful not to alienate one at the expense of the other. So I absolutely love that. I guess that's why you are in risk. So in your world, you know, the line between risk management and prevention is often blurred, right? Is there a real distinction between the two, or are they similar?
So remember, risk management is really the identification, your evaluation, as well as monitoring of any event, whether it be a threat or opportunity that may impact your business, you know, and assessing and understanding the probability of it. So in this particular fraternity, understanding your emerging risks is key, like I said earlier on. So you could say that it is a tool for prevention, because there's a lot of forecasting that happens with risk management, but it's also a tool where you can use it as a corrective measure. So are they the same? I would say risk management encompasses all. Prevention, corrective, because it is about understanding where you're at and how to prevent certain things from happening, or how to seize or how to maximize certain things, certain opportunity or events.
Absolutely. So looking at how the response mechanism that have been happening since the pandemic in South Africa especially, what do you think is the single most important thing that leadership, both in corporate as well as in government, should mitigate in the next 5 to 10 years?
Yeah. We've been over the years talking about business being responsive, organization changing their way of work so that it's more agile. I think the pandemic is actually telling us that we need to start focusing on employee resilience, because right now we have a lot of people that had to go through a very trying time when it comes to COVID, but with the expectation from corporates and themselves to perform. So the issue or the risks that we should look at now when it comes to employee resilience is that of mental health. I feel very passionate about this particular topic, because I think it's something as a topic generally that is shied away from. And in certain instances or parts of the world, it could have a stigma, but it is real, you know? And with the pandemic, I think we will see more and more people experiencing mental health. because in some instances, the workspace created a space where people could neutralize and almost like not fully experience, you know, their own or move away from their own mental health issues, right? But now with this, you know, being locked up, especially last year in the beginning, imagine someone who had no family, had to be alone. There's a lot that happens to that individual. Imagine people that that are already, because we do have individuals in society that have mental health, depression and all of these things. And now they had to cope with it at home. And the question is, are there support structures? Are there support programs to assist those individuals so that they continue to perform the way they are performing? So that, for me, employer resilience is a big part that we need to consider as from a risk perspective, from an organizational perspective, but also from a societal perspective. And I would urge organizations to start looking into that.
Absolutely.
So no more just business resilience. Let's talk employer resilience as well.
Yeah, I love that. I think that is important. When I reflect on, you know, people that just don't survive, they thrive. The common thread is resilience. You know, it's not the absence of problems, it's the presence of problems, but the ability to move through them.
Exactly.
And standing. I love that. Brenda, when you look back at you as a young 10, 13-year-old, and you look at yourself now, what do you wish to tell that young girl? What do you wish that girl knew, you know, then that you know today?
Yeah. I would tell that young girl, the young Brenda, that it's okay to be different. I think in my life story, Sarah, there was always that thing that said, you are different. In the sense that I was the only Black in a colored community amongst my friends. So I was always the Black girl. And I moved to the Eastern Cape where I was the Black girl, but I was the Black girl that didn't know the culture. So, and it takes a lot out of you, you know, if you don't understand your own uniqueness and appreciate your uniqueness. I think if I were to talk to that young Bryn, I would say to her, it's okay. It's okay to be different. It's okay not to know. But later on, I would also tell her when I was trying to attain all that I was attaining, it's also okay not to get everything you've planned. Because I think with the changes in my life and around about, maybe let's say 16, 17, and having smelled success, I wanted to go for more. But then I needed to be comfortable that I might plan it, but it will not always happen as planned. And I need to be okay with that. And it took a long time as a young girl to understand that. So two main things: be fine with who you are, embrace your uniqueness, and it's okay. At every point in your life, it's okay. You can do it again. It's okay. There's time.
Yeah. It just reminded me of this. There's an American girl that's got cancer. She went on to, I think, American Idols, if I'm not mistaken. But, you know, and she was saying, you know, she's got 2% chance of survival. But that's not zero. And it's not to be okay. So absolutely love that. That took me right back to that song which she sang. Yeah. So we're coming down to the end of our chat, and I'm just like, I wish we could go on and on, because you just have really shared lots of nuggets, and I would like to appreciate you for that. But in closing, you know, describe your best failure or your best challenge and how it propelled you forward.
My best challenge or failure, let me put it that way, was actually quite recently when I was doing my PhD. So with all the trying to attain and trying to move forward, I had a personal goal that I had set for myself. So I had set at age 13, I said I wanted to be a doctor, I will get a PhD. And I had told myself I'll get this PhD before I'm 35. And as I journeyed through my journey, at the beginning it started off nicely because I registered for my PhD at the age of 32, and 3 years, I'll be done. But little did I know that life had other plans in place. Being a mother, personal challenges, work commitments, all of the things that were in play, and I didn't manage to do it at age 35. Then naturally, I then said, I can just wait it out. I just told myself, people don't get a PhD that early. You know, I started to make it light in my mind. And I think when it came to when I was 37, so this is 5 years later, the university wrote me a letter. Hi, Brenda, if you do not finish, we're kicking you out.
Sounds like a love letter.
It was a love letter. Oh my goodness, did I not have to draw all the strengths and all the might I have in me to complete this? And I did. And yet again, it's my one of my greatest achievements. I managed to finish my PhD in a period of a year and a half, which was quite quickly. But that whole process from age 33 to the age 37 was like a whole awakening. And that letter was like a hard moment, and it pushed me forward. So that was my biggest, I'll say, personal failure, because it's something I had set out for myself as a 13-year-old, but it was also humbling in itself. So yes, that was my personal most greatest failure.
Absolutely. I love that story. I don't know whether it's a love letter or it's I'm done with you later. Once again, Mabru, thank you so much. And everybody listening, that was Brenda, an amazing, amazing woman, a friend, a South African, and she is the future of risk management in South Africa.
Thank you. Thank you, Sarah. Thank you for having me.
Because It's There with Sarah Khumalo is proudly sponsored by Vuma. Connection lies at the heart of everything Vuma does. It drives important conversations, brings communities together, and creates opportunities for greatness. Connecting Africa's women empowers them to be extraordinary, and we are here to do that. Visit vumatel.co.za for more.